Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're using this last week of the year to revisit some notable interviews of the past in our second hour. Today you'll hear our 2013 interview with Constance Hale, the author of a book on writing well called Sin and Syntax. Since the interview is pre-recorded, we're unable to take any new phone calls or emails today. Maybe your attention wandered in English class back in school. Maybe you just could not quite keep up with the parts of speech and still confuse conjunctions with prepositions. Maybe you had a boring teacher and got annoyed with the idea that you had to know the rules of writing before you could break the rules of writing. Well, today's guest holds to that idea, but her work cannot fairly be called boring. Constance Hale is a journalist based in San Francisco. She covers writing at sinandsyntax.com and is the author of both Wired Style and Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch. There's a paperback version of her book out called Sin and Syntax, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose. And Constance Hale is our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange today. Connie, welcome.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
It's good to have you here. Any change between the 1999 hardcover and this paperback edition?
A lot of changes, yeah. There was a paperback of the earlier edition, so this is an all-new edition. Has a new cover, has a new subtitle. But more importantly, there were two major changes. One is that things, especially in language changes so quickly that language books, especially if you're trying to capture the zeitgeist, can feel dated really quickly. So I took out all the references to Al Gore and Monica Lewinsky and put in references to Joe Biden and Sarah Palin, and mostly wanted to have the examples be a little fresher. The other major change was that since I wrote the first edition, I teach writing all the time to writers, journalists, professors, and I had developed a lot of exercises that corresponded to the chapters, because I think it's one thing to read a book like this, it's another thing to go practice the things that it preaches. So what I really wanted to do in this new edition was to include a few exercises at the end of every chapter so that someone could practice the grammar. Like, I think it's so funny you said, that what's the difference between a conjunction and a preposition? Well, I'll make sure you know that by the time you finish this book. And there are also a couple of writing prompts. So ultimately, the book really isn't about grammar at all. It's about writing. So I wanted to give people a chance to use some of the wonderful passages in the book as models for their own little writing assignments.
All right. I'm glad you made that underscoring about grammar, because I know that when we do talk about grammar with other authors and people who teach grammar, that often the phones will ring off the hook because people love to talk about grammar. This is not so much about grammar as the act of writing itself. I'm curious to know, though, since you mentioned that you teach writing, I just had this flash of Roger Clemens talking about busting up the scar tissue on my lower body. Mm-hmm. The idea that he really needed to kind of loosen up and kind of do things in a fresh way. And I'm curious to know if, since you teach people who write for different reasons, journalists and in other fields as well, if they get into bad habits and tend to stay there, or just form habits and then have to kind of break up the scar tissue when they get to you.
Oh, absolutely. Everyone does. And, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with the way that we're taught to write. We're taught grammar in a way that's completely boring, as you said in your intro. And usually I think we're taught grammar too young. It's because grammar is pretty abstract. It's a pretty abstract way of thinking of language. And I think that often it has all these weird Latinate words like, you know, predicate nominative and stuff like that that give people hives. And so I think partly the way we're taught about language isn't the most dynamic way possible. Excuse me. And then, so we don't learn that stuff when it's taught to us. And then the way we're taught about writing is in English class. So we're taught to write English papers for an English teacher. And we figure out that English teacher gets impressed by dictionary words, so we use them. And we figure out that one way to write an 8-page paper is to do a lot of padding. And so I think all of us develop really bad habits when we learn to write. It's just the way we happen to be taught to write isn't the best way, in my opinion. And so I think we all have some really bad habits that we have to break. And then certainly those of us who are trying to write professionally can get into bad habits as well. So absolutely, a lot of what this book is, you've taken a look at it, there's one section in every chapter devoted to what I call cardinal sins, mm-hmm. which are either those bad habits, the scar tissue, using Roger Clemens's analogy, or their errors just committed out of stupidity and laziness.
Getting into a rhythm and staying there, even if it's not necessarily a good rhythm.
Right.
You write that language is paradox right up front in the book. What does that mean?
Well, there's so many ways that language is paradox. I think one thing is, for example, the idea of grammar. Well, I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth, because on the one hand, I say I want you to break the rules, but I also say you can't really break the rules until you know them. And so I don't like grammar. I'm not a grammar. I mean, I don't dislike grammar, but I'm not a grammar, you know, queen or nutcase. But if we want to write well, and if we want to call ourselves writers, and if we want to do it seriously, we really need to learn some of this stuff. And yet, again, here comes another twist in the road.
Right.
A lot of the rules that were set down 400 years ago when they decided to invent English grammar wholesale, a lot of the rules of grammar don't actually apply to English, and they're kind of false rules. So that's another paradox. Just within grammar, there are some paradoxes. There are some things you do need to know. There are a lot of things you don't need to know, particularly if all you want to do is be a good writer. So that's one thing. But also, there are paradoxes like the difference between language and speech and language and writing. We do some things when we're speaking. For example, we use words to add emphasis, like very or really. And that does add emphasis in speaking, and it actually takes away emphasis in writing. So there are little paradoxes like that.
And I'll tell you something, that particular section really struck me, because I was forced to confront the fact that as a broadcast writer, my writing is to write the way that people sound when they speak. I'm writing for the ear, not for the eye, and it's a different kind of thing altogether.
It is, and when we speak, we have access to things like tone and timbre and rhythm and enunciation that we don't have on the page, so we have to think of other ways to create effects on the page.
Constance Hale from 2013 talking about sin and syntax here on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back to this interview with a reminder that we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Constance Hale in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are going back to an interview from a couple of years ago. Constance Hale wowed us with her grip of the English language and her command of its use in writing. She wrote a book called Sin and Syntax, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose. Since this is pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today, but now let's go back to Constance. I'm reading your quotation of William Zinsser in the introduction in the book, where he talked about the four articles of faith on writing: clarity, simplicity, brevity, and humanity. And then you put five rules on top of that as well.
Well, yeah, I guess not on top of that, but I guess I riff on his. I think his don't go far enough for my taste. So take simplicity, for example, and this is going back to the idea of paradox, which we just ended on. It's not, I don't want to encourage people to be simple. Yes, use the most direct, precise word possible, and don't go get all complicated on us. But the point of writing isn't to be simple. It's to be deep. It's to say something meaningful. So I think I try to maybe make some fine points or take his articles of faith one step further, and I also try to translate them for people into, you know, sort of how do you get there. But even economy, there's such a big premium now on writing short. You're supposed to be able to tweet well and post on Facebook well, which I don't disagree with. I think we should all, no matter what we're writing, we should work to craft it, and everything we write can be part of our practice of getting better as a writer. But I love long writing. I love, fluid phrasing and deep ideas. So even the idea of economy, I think, well, yes, you don't want to waste words, you don't want to waste people's time, but the point isn't just to be able to write 140-character tweets.
Right, which obviously is a big difference from the 1999 version of Sin and Syntax in book form. Does that box ever really feel like a really tight constraint upon you?
The 140-character
right.
box?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I feel all the time, I think that's why the most successful tweets are oftentimes Mark Twain quotes,
uh-huh.
short, or links to something else. Like, there's very little you can say in that space, but you can certainly try to say more. You know, I just think of writing or all these different media as being like an accordion. You know, there are ways to say something in very few words. You can go from a tweet to then a Facebook post, which you have four lines, to then maybe a blog post, in which you have a little more space, and then in my case, to a feature, 3,000-word feature article for a magazine, which is pretty glorious when you get to do it.
I'll tell you something. Having talking to usually three authors a week on average on the Jefferson Exchange, I've read a lot of people's writing over the last 4 years or so, and come to the conclusion that some people are amazingly efficient. They can say in two sentences what it takes other people two pages to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the things that really strikes me the most, is that I guess it's a matter of style, but you just have to wonder how hard some people are trying.
That's true, and I think most people don't try very hard, honestly. Most of us are in a rush most of the time, and most of us don't have the discipline to really practice, follow this practice, consider writing a practice. On the other hand, who would want to kiss Joyce goodbye?
Right, for sure.
You know, there are these, every time I read a passage from James Joyce, I'm just bowled over. And so I think, you know, the trick as a professional writer today is to figure out how and when you need to be short and you need to be brief because people have short attention spans, et cetera, and when you really can stretch out and do something more beautiful.
And so the principles of prose that Constance Hale puts out in Sin and Syntax: relish every word, aim deep but be simple, take risks, seek beauty, and find the right pitch. Mm-hmm. Find the right pitch means what, Connie?
Well, I tried to, it's sort of two things. One is this idea of, I use the word pitch purposely because there's this idea of musicality, and that I really believe that prose has the potential to be musical. Like, a lot of times we think, oh, only poetry can be beautiful, but I believe prose can be poetic as well, and we should strive for that. So part of it is just that idea of where's the music in the sentence, and what is the right music for a particular sentence or a particular story. So, like, for example, what voice is right for this, what tone is right for this. But the other idea of pitch, which is so important, is understanding your audience and pitching your paragraph or sentence or whatever it is to that audience. So something that I think a lot of novice writers, I think you get better and better at this the more you write professionally, is to understand whom you're speaking to and to write for that audience.
Whether it's an image in your head or the sound of their voices or something, but some other way to at least make sure that those people are with you in a sense while you're writing.
Yeah, and
this.
I often pick a reader. You know, when I wrote the first edition of Wired Style, actually my first book, which was all about technology, I thought, I want to write a book that my grandmother will enjoy, because my grandmother read the business page of the New York Times every day,
mm-hmm.
but she was not hip to technology. So how can I write about technology in a way that's fun, that, you know, my colleagues will enjoy, but it will help be helpful to my grandmother? And I had my grandmother in my head when I was writing. Sometimes, just to give you another example of this, right now I'm writing an article for Honolulu Magazine about the state of the Hawaiian language, which is going through a huge comeback. Well, that article that I write for Honolulu is going to be different. It's going to have a different pitch than an article that I would write for, say, the Oregonian or the Smithsonian. When the audience doesn't know Hawaii as intimately as someone from Honolulu does. So I'm going to use different language. I'm going to make different references. And that is the idea of understanding your audience as well.
All right. Constructing it differently, not just the way the sounds goes as well. We have an email here from Michelle in Arcata. She says, I just wanted to send a note letting you know that I bought my husband your book for his birthday.
Yay!
I added it as an afterthought to the other books I was purchasing in order to receive free shipping.
I'll take it. I'll take a buyer however I get it.
Sure. She says, my husband is currently working on a book and was having some challenges. He has repeatedly said that he appreciates all the books I bought him to help with his writing, but your book truly has been the most helpful and helped him reach a new level with his writing.
That's so cool.
That is from Michelle in Arcata. Let's take a phone call here as well. Here's Mike in Eagle Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Connie Hale. Sin and Syntax, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose is her book.
Oh, good morning. I am so old that I was taught that pronouns always had to agree with their antecedents. And last night I heard a television newscaster on a local station say, a person of interest turned themselves in to authorities in a criminal case.
Mike, was that Channel 12?
It was.
I spent years telling them not to do that, but go ahead.
Well, I heard it both at 6 and again at 11. But, well, I know why this happens. You know, we're trying to avoid sexism in language, and our language doesn't really accommodate that very well. But I'm wondering how your guest deals with these kinds of things and where the language is going in that regard.
All right. Pronouns is a big part of the book. Mike, thanks for the call. Appreciate that, Connie.
Oh, Mike, I appreciate that question so much. You've kind of went right at, you went for the jugular here. That this particular problem is, I think, one of the, if I were to list the top three problems in grammar today, the use of they when a singular pronoun is required or preferred is probably at the top of my list. And I hate to say it, but our president is one of the big offenders.
Oh, that's right. You have a bunch of examples from him in the book.
Yeah, he's a great rhetorician. And most, I actually went to the same high school as he did, so I know that he did. I know that we had good English teachers, but he didn't learn that lesson. So, right, there are a lot of reasons we do it. One is a good one, which is wanting to be sensitive to gender issues. We used to just use he, and that doesn't feel cool anymore. But the problem with this is twofold. First of all, it makes our language ambiguous and vague, and we never want to go in that direction. When you say they, when you mean he, or when you mean she, or when you mean he or she, it's less specific, and we don't want to do that. Number two, there are so many easy ways to fix it. All you have to do is put the whole sentence into plural, put the antecedent, we call it the noun that came first. In this case, I believe it was anyone. If you put that into a plural form, then it's fine to use they. And the third thing is, and this is going back to why it's a problem, there are sentences in which when you use they instead of he or she, it's really unclear whom you're referring to. And that's the problem.
And so, for example, when you're talking about the Oregon Department of Forestry, they don't become a they suddenly because it's
right,
an
it. A department. Mm-hmm. And it helps a reader understand you if you do it right. It helps a reader understand that you're still referring to the department if you use it. I may be losing the battle on this one. I am a stickler. This is one of the things that I am holding the line on. There are two things, actually, where we may see in 100 years that we're not even having this argument anymore because it seems like such a groundswell in support of they as a singular plural. And language does change, and there are many, many instances of words that used to be used one way and aren't used that way anymore, and pronouns have changed also over the 1,500-year history of the English language. So these things do change, and I'm the first one to concede them. The other thing that bothers me a lot, but I think I've lost the battle, is the difference between who and whom, in particular at the beginning of a sentence. So you're supposed to use who when it's a subject of a sentence, and you're supposed to use whom when that's an object, but most people say, who do you trust? You is the subject of that sentence, and whom is the object, so it really should be whom do you trust? Mm-hmm. But there's something about putting whom at the beginning of a sentence that just sounds stuffy or British or something, and most Americans prefer to use whom. Prefer to use who.
I'm glad you brought up British because you are writing for an American audience in this book, and there are some differences, particularly in things like we were just talking about with the pronoun and noun agreement. There are differences between American English and British English. For example, referring to sports teams, you'll hear a British broadcaster say, Coventry City have never won the FA Cup.
Right. I would say that's the biggest or the most jarring difference between British English and American English is that they're called collective nouns, so things like team, band, group, the British will consider that to be a plural noun, where we consider it to be singular. A lot of confusion there. There can be confusion there, but and the whole idea of collective nouns is weird for us too. Like the band put its guitars. How do you do that?
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes you're trying to say that every member of the band put his or her guitar into the van. Oh my gosh, it gets so complicated. Simple thing. So it's pretty easy to fix. You just say the members of the band put their guitars into the van.
Right.
Most of these things, I think that's why I make a fuss over it, because most of these things are so easy to fix and do correctly that we really shouldn't allow ourselves to just get lazy and loose in language, because there's an easy fix and everything stays more clear.
Constance Hale fixes these in her book, Sin and Syntax, How to Create Wicked Good Prose. She also maintains a website at sinandsyntax.com.
This interview on The Exchange is pre-recorded, so the usual give and take is not present. We're not giving the phone number and the email address because we can't take any new phone calls or emails today.
Jeannie in Medford, thanks for waiting. Welcome to The Exchange.
Oh, hi. I learned to use prepositions correctly, unfortunately, in a murder trial with two brothers. He had the gun, and then he shot him, and who do you mean, this brother? So that was an unfortunate way to learn it, and I sure didn't learn it in school. And secondly, I had a boss that, a great speaker on aerodynamics worldwide, and he would say, now that airplane ain't going to fly if it doesn't such and such. And I thought, you can't say that. You know, mothers don't say ain't. And what I really like is your analogy to music and timing. It's when, like a drum beat that comes in. And the other comment is, I lived in a commune once, and when I asked, do you have a colander? I was cooking, and I just moved in. I said, you know, like a spaghetti strainer? She goes, you mean a sieve? And then it occurred, I felt ashamed, and I didn't like that feeling, and I thought, you know what? As long as you knew what you understood what I meant, then give me the darn thing.
All right,
Jean. Okay, I'll listen.
Thank you for that.
So many great comments there. First of all, oh, what a difference a word makes, and we use words differently in different parts of the country. I completely agree that none of us should be snobbish about language. I prefer to be playful about it and to laugh at a difference like that, the difference between colander and sieve in different parts of the country. But, you know, ain't is a really interesting example. And you probably get this from the title of my book, Sin and Syntax, I'm pretty tolerant of non-standard English. In fact, I love non-standard English. I grew up in Hawaii speaking Hawaiian Creole, which is very non-standard.
Wow.
And fortunately, my parents had pretty good grammar and insisted that we speak correctly, speak standard English at the dinner table. And so I grew up speaking both languages, and I think it gave me a tolerance for non-standard languages that maybe some other, quote-unquote, language mavens don't have. But this idea of ain't is interesting because I did some research on it for my book, Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch, which is all about the history of the English verb. And, you know, really, ain't is, if you look back at the evolution of ain't in the United States, ain't is closer to English as it was spoken in colonial times than one would think. It's not just non-standard. We used to say, I am-n't.
Really? Really?
Sure, because when you think about it, I am not is what we would say, right? Well, we don't say that anymore, and ain't is this kind of convenient form of to be in a weird tense that stuck around in certain non-standard Englishes while standard English went in a different direction. And so there again, there's a reason not to be snobby about the way other people speak, because there are things that double negatives, for example, have existed in English forever, and it's a little bit crazy to look down your nose at some things, because they are some things that you think are wrong are a lot more right than you think.
And plus, they're effective, and that's always been a big one for me. Is that and teachers used to say this back too. It's like, okay, these aren't really technically sentences, but they work.
Right.
So
exactly.
You get away with them. You know, you do caution Connie about being verbose. To use simple words, by and large. But it's not just about using short words, because you're also about using the very right words. So why, for example, did you use palliative, and your editor changed that to cure?
That's a famous example of mine. I know you have small papers like this small paper that I worked at in California, which shall remain nameless, and small-minded editors. I was talking about, it was kind of a funny lead. I was a year after the big Loma Prieta earthquake, and I was kind of in the area right where the earthquake had been centered, and it was pretty big shock to the whole psychology of the region. And so I was making some joke about if earthquakes give you the willies, the town had come up with a palliative. And my editor said, we can't use palliative. Our readers have a intellectual age of 12 and they don't know what that means, and changed it to cure. Well, the difference is there's a difference between palliative and cure. Palliative makes something better. A cure fixes something. So to me, choosing a four-letter word over a long word, a more common word or a less common word, is fine most of the time, but not when the long, less common word is actually precisely what you mean. And if a reader doesn't get it, the reader can figure it out from the context, or the reader can go pick up a dictionary. But that's the only way we all become better writers and better readers, is that if we kind of enjoy the differences, the subtle differences between words.
And somewhere an editor is not knowing it, but thanking you for not revealing his name. Because assuming the audience is an age of 12 for reading ability, wow, that's
but an insult, yeah.
Yeah, really. Constance Hale on the Jefferson Exchange from August of 2013, talking about her book, Sin and Syntax, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose. You'll hear more from Constance Hale from that interview from 2013 when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're replaying another interview to get us to the end of the year here on the Jefferson Exchange. This is Constance Hale from August of 2013 talking about writing, good, crisp, precise writing in her book Sin and Syntax, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose. Because it's pre-recorded, no phone calls or emails today, but here we go. Obviously, you start with the parts of speech, so you work through nouns and verbs and everything. And in nouns, interesting, there's a section about choosing a name. You talk about Twitter, and did Twitter really hit the nail on the head? And conversely, did, for example, patch.com not?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, the way some things... I'm not sure whether the name really makes the product or whether the product makes the name, but it's certainly true that there's some bad brand names out there.
Absolutely, but Twitter's a good one, huh?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, yeah, and they have their icon, their logo is the bird, and I don't know, there's something that captured the imagination. It's light, it's easy, it conveys the whole idea that conveys, I think, what they wanted to encourage people to do. Interestingly, though, the founder of Twitter is now starting a new product or medium, platform, whatever. It's called Medium. It's a website, and he's trying to create a platform to encourage longer-form writing. So interesting that... I think that he understands this idea that, you know, it depends on the moment, it depends on the audience. There's some things that for which Twitter is appropriate, and there's some things for which you need a longer, more space and more depth.
But really, he's calling it Medium?
Mm-hmm. That's the name of the new site. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, have you heard what Ernie Kovacs once said about how you know television is a medium?
No.
He said, you can tell television is a medium because anything well done is rare. That's why I have to wonder about the choice of that for a new service here. Let's take a call. We have Lori and Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Connie Hale, Sin and Syntax.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, so my pet peeve is lie and lay, mm-hmm. and the difference between the two, and I've just about given up hope. I thought I'd get your take on that.
All right, good question.
Don't give up hope. Never give up hope. it's such a great, this is probably belongs, I don't know, I might need to make it my top five. We've already gotten to three of them. So of the sort of worst and most persistent grammar errors, grammatical errors. So the difference is simple, actually. Lay is what we call a transitive verb, which means that it needs an object to kind of complete the idea. So I lay the silver on the table, for example, or a chicken lays an egg. And lie is intransitive, which means it doesn't need an object. You can just say, I lie, or the dog lies down, down being an adverb, not an object. That's the difference between the verbs. One is transitive, one is intransitive. The problem is that when you start taking those verbs and changing them into other tenses, the past tense of lay is laid, and the past participle is laid, And then the past tense of lie is lay, L-A-Y, and the past participle is lain. And so you have this unfortunate situation where once you get, you think you understand the difference between lay and lie, and then lie turns into lay in the past tense, and everything gets scrambled. So it's pretty understandable why they're perennially confused. It's easy to sort it out if you just remember, and I use the mnemonic device now, I lay me down to sleep, I lay me, myself. So you just need a little trick like that to remind yourself. But again, most people, especially in speaking, do not take the time to think it through or to sort it through. And as a result, we get lays lying all over the place where lies should be.
Is part of the problem the fact that, nobody wants to say I was lying?
because of the big one, how there's another meaning.
Right.
I guess so. I don't think that's really the problem. I think there's just this confusion. There's this confusion, and it's not very hard to understand the difference between transitive and intransitive verbs. But again, that's one of those. Oh my God! It feels like grammar. It reminds me of ninth grade. Let me get out of here. It just requires a little bit of work to understand the difference, and then it's easy.
All right, let's take another call from Zelda in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Connie Hale.
Hi. My question is about who and that. I read all the time when the sentence will say the person that did this, whatever. And I think that it should be the person who.
Yeah, the man who robbed the bank, not the man that robbed the bank.
Right, and that refers to objects, not people. Am I nitpicking?
Let's find out.
I'm sorry to say, not only are you nitpicking, but you're a little bit wrong.
Really?
Yeah. Well, so, and by the way, these are called relative pronouns, and there's a really cool part of the book that talks about them. So a couple of relative pronouns get scrambled a lot. So our caller left out one, which is which. So there's a lot of confusion about when do you use who, when do you use that, and when do you use the which. That can actually be used for people or things. Who is for people, which is for things. So that is kind of in between who and which. But there is a finer distinction that needs to be made, and it's the absolute geekiest thing in the book. It is the hardest thing to explain. I think I will tie your readers into knots if I try to explain it, but it comes down to being there are two different kinds of clauses that we call essential clauses, and then clauses we call inessential clauses. And it basically means sometimes there's information in the clause that is needed in the sentence, or the sentence won't make sense, versus sometimes we have a little clause or a phrase where the information could be taken out, the whole phrase or clause could be taken out of the sentence, and it doesn't matter, the sentence still makes sense. And that's actually what determines when we use who, when we use that, when we use which part of it. So there are two things that determine. One is, are we talking about people or are we talking about things? And then is it essential information in the sentence or is it inessential information in the sentence? And so it's actually correct to use that for people when it's essential information in the sentence. I said it was, I warned you that this was geeky.
Absolutely. Ariel, no town given, emailed this. She says, how about these phrases? If he would have done it, that's one. They invited my husband and I. And her third example is, you can give it to myself or one of my colleagues.
Ouch. Okay, so let me scramble the order. The first, the second one was about my, you can
they
give
invited
it to my
husband and I.
Yeah. So this is, this idea of my husband and I, that's a little compound, right? We have two people joined by an and. And these cause so much trouble. Usually when it's at the beginning of the sentence, we usually do it correctly. My husband and I are going to the store. Again, I is the pronoun that you need to use when it's the subject of the sentence. And then when it's an object of the sentence, like they gave it to my husband and me, you need to use me because it's the object. And it's if you're trying to figure out how to do this, just take out the husband part.
Right, so they gave it to
me.
You
would say, I go to the store, and they gave it to me. And so if you're trying to figure it out, if you're writing a sentence and you're not sure which is correct, just take out the other part of the other half, and it'll be really clear to most English users which is correct. For some reason, when we do those compounds and we move them around in sentences, we screw them up, and this is the one grammatical error that I make more often than anything else is when that, you know, my husband and me or or my mom and I, when it follows a preposition, it's supposed to be me, and I get that wrong all the time, and my aunts slap me on the wrist and correct me over it. I get made fun of in the family for this particular error. Now, she had two other errors.
If he would have done it, and you can give it to myself or one of my colleagues.
Right, and myself. Oh, gosh, I write about this in the book. You know, for some reason, people think myself sounds, I don't know, more important or better than me. I don't know why, but most of the time when we use myself, we should just use me. It's this kind of pretentious pronoun, and so I care a lot about that. The would have done it thing is actually, it has to do with verb tenses, and it's kind of a regionalism. So in the South, I mean, people conjugate, you know, put verbs into different tenses in different ways in different subcultures. And would have done it is pretty common, and I don't know what else to say about it. It's wrong in some cases, and it's right in other. I would have done it if you'd told me to. That's correct.
Uh-huh.
I actually cover this quite a bit in Vex Hex Smash Smooch. It's just something that's taken over like wildfire.
Like kudzu in the South. Let's go to Jim in Jacksonville. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Connie Hale. Jim, you there?
Hello, Jeffrey. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, great. Good morning. Say, I got in on this discussion a little bit late, but when I heard the subtitle of the book, Wicked Good Prose, my head about exploded.
Are you from Boston?
I'm an adverb campaigner, and I don't believe you can modify an adjective with another adjective. So shouldn't the subtitle be Wickedly Good Prose?
Ah.
I'll take the comment.
All right, thanks, Jim.
This is so fun that Jim commented on the subtitle, because actually the first edition of my book, the subtitle was How to Craft Wickedly Effective Prose, and I hated that subtitle. It was my editor that came up with it, or the marketing department, and I hated it because it's exactly the kind of prose that I tell people not to do.
Because it's a little florid, isn't it? Wickedly effective.
It is. Yeah. Wickedly effective just seems, it doesn't roll off the tongue, it doesn't seem like that's the way we talk. The whole idea of modifying an adjective like effective with a word like wicked, it was just all wrong to me. And so I started using Wicked Good on my website, and that was a huge reason that I wanted to do a new edition of the book, was that so that I could change the subtitle. And you know, it goes to this idea of, do you like slang or do you not like slang? Do you like non-standard English or do you not like non-standard English? I love the way people talk. I love Wicked Good prose more than Wickedly Effective prose. And this is going to come down to taste, but I do, in the book, encourage people to break rules when they are breaking them intentionally, intelligently, and with a sense of play. And there's a sense of play there that I hate it when we talk about language and we talk about grammar in such a way that it makes everybody feel uptight and that they're either doing it right or they're doing it wrong. And as I mentioned earlier, this kind of judgmentalism about language. I love it when people can speak English and just enjoy the play of words and enjoy when someone takes something and tweaks it and maybe even intentionally does something that's grammatically incorrect, but they do it because it's fun and because it has associations that they want to include in the meaning. So anyway, that's a long explanation, but I've thought way more about this subtitle mm-hmm. than any phrase ought to be thought about.
Well, you know, the phrase Wicked Good is moving outside the Boston area now, too, so that's getting a lot more usage in the countryside.
Yeah.
Let's take some calls from people we don't hear from very often. Here's Bree in Shady Cove. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. I'm fairly new to the Rogue Valley area from another part of Oregon, and one of the things I hear down here is the phrase these ones to refer to multiple objects, and it's kind of jarring to me. I haven't really heard it a lot. Is that an accurate way to refer, or is it redundant?
So, like, pick up these ones, but not those ones?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Bree.
Wow, that's a really interesting question. I don't even know how to answer it. These ones, those ones, well, those will be the ones over there, and these over here. I don't think it's wrong, but I could stand to be corrected. What do you think, Jeffrey?
I think it's one of those overly descriptive ones where you just say, pick up these.
Mm-hmm.
But these ones, it's kind of like when people say that one thing.
Right. You know, in other languages, it's so interesting because when it comes to pronouns, I mean, you'd think we have a lot to keep track of in English. We've been talking so much this hour about pronouns, but other languages have so many more pronouns than we do. And we're talking about, these are demonstrative pronouns. These and those are, technically, they're called demonstrative pronouns. And I'm learning a little bit of Hawaiian. And Hawaiian has all these pronouns, like keia. There are things that mean these, keia over here and kela over there. And there's one more which I can't even remember right now. But also in Hawaiian, there are pronouns for, the pronouns for we are amazing because I could say mako, and that means Jeffrey, you and me, but not those people listening.
Uh-huh.
Or I could say kako, and that means all of us, so your audience and you and me. Or I could say oko, and that means those people over there, those two over there. Or I could say lako, and that means those over there, but more than two. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Or kaua means the two of us. I think there are like 10 different pronouns to indicate we, because you can have so much more specificity about which we exactly you're talking about. So... anyway, that's just my little riff on demonstrative pronouns, because some other languages even have more of them.
All right, we can squeeze in one final call. Here's Colin in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Connie Hale, Sin and Syntax.
Hi, yes. I have a question about good and well, and it's very confusing because they have different meanings. Also, what is your take on ending sentences with prepositions? And I'll listen off the phone.
We just got about half a minute here, Connie.
Okay, ending a sentence with a preposition is easy. It's fine. You can do it. Don't forget what your grammar teacher told you. Go ahead and end a sentence on a preposition. The difference between good and well is another one that's actually simpler than most people think. Good is an adjective. Well is an adverb. And almost 95% of the time, that's all you need to know. The one difference is when we're talking about our health, I say, I feel well today. So there's one instance when we might use well as an adjective. Pretty easy.
Well, as usual, we talk about the writing and grammar, and the phones ring off the hook, and they did again today. Constance Hale wrote Sin and Syntax, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose. Connie, thank you for writing it. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey.
It's great
Loved
to have
it.
You.